Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we have a very, very powerful show for you today. In the second half of this week's show, we're going to be talking about a topic that becomes more and more urgent each and every day: fascism, learning from history, and confronting what we need to do today. We'll hear a short clip, the trailer actually, from a talk given by Bob Avakian, and the talk is called "The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the Name of Humanity, We Refuse to Accept a Fascist America. A Better World is Possible." Now, in the full talk and over 2 hours of questions and answers, Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, lays out a compelling, in-depth, and comprehensive answer to what we're facing with the Trump-Pence regime and what we must do now. After that, we'll hear an interview I did last year with author George Prochnick on when it's too late to stop fascism, according to Stefan Zweig. In the 1930s, Austrian writer Stefan Zweig was the most translated author in the world. He fled Austria just ahead of the Nazis, and in 1941 spent the final months of his life furiously writing a memoir, A Warning to the Future. We talk with Prochnick, author of The Impossible Exile, Stefan Zweig at the End of the World, about the assault on the truth, the widespread idea that it couldn't happen in Germany, and we'll talk about the obvious lessons for today. But before any of that, I am very pleased to welcome to the show my next guest. Raoul Peck is the director of the new film, The Young Karl Marx. This is a film that will give you a whole new and completely refreshing and inspiring understanding of the birth and development of communist revolution. It focuses on 5 years from 1843 to 1848 and tells the story of the 26-year-old Karl Marx, along with Frederick Engels, Jenny Marx, and Mary Burns, and their fight to bring a scientific understanding to the revolutionary movement of the times. In doing so, Marx developed the science of revolution. And today, this science has been given new life by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, the Marx of our times, and the architect of a whole new framework of human emancipation, the new synthesis of communism, popularly referred to as the new communism. With that as a background, it is with great pleasure that I was able to see Raoul Peck's film, The Young Karl Marx, and learn about the earliest days of and battles to establish the science of revolution. Raoul Peck, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Well, let's jump into this. Why that period in particular? You're talking 1843 to 1848, and you really zero in on that. And I thought it was, one, a period that has not been paid enough attention to, but it was also something that really, it was just a very refreshing place to start. So I wanted to ask you about that, too.
Yeah, well, it was a very difficult choice. I mean, to be frank with you, throughout the different drafts of the screenplay, we basically started from Marx as a 12-year-old student in his gymnasium school to his time in exile in London when he was 32, 33. But little by little, we focused on the period starting in France or a little bit before in Germany when he's expelled, because somehow it's the most interesting and intriguing moment. That's where the ideas are developing. And that's where the first step are taking in organizing the working class, the non-existent working class until that moment. Because, of course, most of the head of the movement, especially the utopian socialists, those were hand workers. You know, they were tailors, they were woodworkers, they were, you know, they were not workers. You know, they were working in factories. Mm-hmm. So Marx and Engels come into that, juncture and changed everything and gave it a structure, gave it a theory, and even an approach, a more, I would say, educational approach. Because for Marx, as they say in one of the scenes, you know, ignorance never helped anybody. So you need to know who is your enemy and how do you fight that enemy, you know. So it became almost natural to tackle that moment that is not really well known, because people always try to go to whatever monument of Marx writings, and specific the Capitol. The Capitol is somehow the, I would say, the mother work, you know, where he tried to put everything that he has accumulated over the year, you know, because his approach was to be a scientific one, you know, so he needed a book like this. And that's why it took so much time to write. But the evolution of the ideas, the beginning and also the energy of the youth was important to us. You know, when he said, you know, philosophers, have spent time analyzing the world when the what it needs to be now is to do now is to change it. This is a phenomenal decision at that moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I was just thinking of that. In fact, you know, one of the things related to that is the opening scene to the film really does set the tone for much of the rest of the film. The fact that the ruthless oppression and the struggle to change it. Let's talk about that opening scene, because that's something that really sort of set me back in my seat when I saw that.
Well, it was necessary to, you know, to show from the beginning the type of violence we are talking about, you know, and blind violence that doesn't make sense. You know, and somehow it's at the core of the, I would say, the reaction of the young Marx, because he's somebody who could not accept inequality and justice and repression. So, and as a journalist, because at the time that's what he was basically. And I love that scene as well, because first it shows you the violence of the time, that these people in the wood, trying to survive by taking wood on the soil, you know, on the bottom of the forest, and those forests belongs to a rich class, and even that they were not allowed by law to use, and this totally contradiction, because when Marx writes, well, if the people don't understand the justice of the law and why and the absurdity of this, so they cannot obey those same law and they are bound to revolt, you know. And in a philosophical aspect and political, this was the best beginning I could have. And you can see from that moment the evolution of Marx and then Engels together.
Mm-hmm. And it really gave something to me. Go ahead.
No, and then visually, of course, that was important, because I knew that the rest of the film, we would not have very much space and room for any, action situation, because they were basically, it was an intellectual fight most of the time, until, you know, the 1848, where they wrote the manifest, the Communist Manifesto. Yeah. So it was important to, you know, to date the moment and to show visually and even in the bodies, you know, what kind of violence we are talking about in that moment in the Western world.
Yeah, and it gave you a very, very sharp sense of the nature of capitalism. When you're looking at this thing, and the point you make in that scene is the attacks on the people who are simply going out and trying to get wood, gather up wood that they can sell in order to survive. And even the dead wood on the ground is verboten. It's very heavy. It's very heavy when you look at that. It's and that's why they're getting killed, because they had the audacity.
Yeah, and very symbolic. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me ask you this, and this is, you know, and again, I keep thinking too. There's so much in terms of what you did with the film, in the early years of Marx, and the portrayal of Marx and Engels, and you know the people involved in there. It was an incredible piece that brought to mind constant things, including references to today. And I had to say, you know, there's a lot of parallels to the world today, and still many of the same questions and issues are posed for all of us, especially when you think about, you know, the immigrants coming into work and the, you know, what's happening to people now. Let's talk about that a little bit, because the social and political crisis there that existed then has been magnified a million times over now.
Well, that was the idea, you know, how do I provide tools to young people of today to understand what's going on? Because those last 40 years, you know, we have had so much incredible changes, but changes that did not bring us much more clarity. On the contrary, it blurred everything. You know, before the end of the Berlin Wall, you could still say, well, there are two sides of the world, and one being the capitalist side, and the other one being the so-called communist countries. So, and at least, you know, coming from the third world myself, you know, I could pick my enemies and my friends, and I would not follow to death, you know, whatever Moscow or any party was telling me on the other side, I knew how to protect myself from the action of the Western world. You know, in Haiti, the 35 years of the dictatorship were basically supported by the United States, you know, and as was many of the coup d'etats in the Latin American continent. So you tend to have, to be suspicious toward any kind of hegemonial attempt. So when that changed with the fall of the Berlin Wall, you know, it's as if capital have won, and then you heard, you know, people like Fukuyama saying, well, it's the end of history. So it's a matter to say also there is no more class struggle, you know. So, and then you add to that, you know, a place where little by little, you know, we, through concentration of the press, through the deconstruction of many institutions or many organizations, you know, the union were attacked very violently during those last 40 years. And then you come up in a time where we are now, we don't even know what real news is and fake news is. Mm-hmm. So I feel we end up in a place of ignorance that is very hard to, to react to. You know, what do you do as an artist, as a writer, as a filmmaker to counter that? Because it's not something you can deal with in a matter of one project, one film, one book, or 1 year. It's really how do we will face the next 30, 40 years. That is what is at stake.
Yeah, exactly.
Because the world like we know it, you know, the capitalism is undergoing an incredible transformation. And as usual, it's going to take time before we can even recognize toward what we are going. Mm-hmm. What we only know is that there are limits to everything right now. There are limits to the energy we can have access to. There are limits to how much food we can grow. There are limits to even how much we can continue to destroy nature, you know, mm-hmm. and all those things. And we know there are limits to the sort of inequality we are in, you know. How far more can you go when you know that 1% of the people own more than 80% of the riches of the world? You know, how far more can you go? You will say, well, 0.2% have 90%, you know. So we are getting into absurd situations. So we know that change is happening right now, but we can't really recognize it. So again, to come back to my film, sorry for this long contextualization, is my attempt, it's a modest attempt to at least deliver some sort of theoretical tool, some instruments to understand what's going on. You know, I'm not sure that, well, I can say yes, I had tremendous impact in discussion in many of the countries where the film came out, you know, in France, in Belgium, in Germany, and I can see how motivated young people were in their discussion, and I hope it will be the same here too. But it's about, you know, how do we regain our capacity of analysis, you know? How do we reverse this permanent growing ignorance about things? The individualization of all any groups, you know? We lost our collective, you know? And there cannot be a real change without a collective, without, you know, our collective minds and ambition for change. So the film is just, you know, how to give the people the capacity to think again.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with filmmaker Raoul Peck. And the name of the film is The Young Karl Marx. It's a film that's coming out all over the world and all over the country. All right, so don't miss this film. That's really important, and I think it's related to this next question, because one of the things that you do, you know, that you present is you present actually a lot of what you're talking about, the social and political crisis that of today. It's treated today with evasive rhetoric and strict adherence to the boundaries that are set by the system itself. And what you bring out in relation to Marx and Engels and the whole movement that developed at that time is that there's a whole lot going on that actually needs people, particularly like when you look at the role of youth, the role of women, the importance of actually the revolution of thought, challenging everything about the accepted norms and then daring to forge a new understanding and a new path, which is really important. It's a constant challenge to the accepted knowledge. And I think that's, and then on that basis, what are you going to do about it?
Exactly. That's the minimum, you know. But unfortunately, we got engaged in this acceleration of everything where, you know, people and young people are being bombarded with all sort of information, sound, images, and ignorance as well. You know, a lot of products are circulating that have no single atom of reality. And so how do you counter that? You know, because one thing we know, we cannot fight if we don't have the right information. You know, otherwise we are bound to do a lot of mistakes. We are like blind people fighting in the dark.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, one question too, and I know our time is running up, but I wanted to actually get a couple more questions in. One is Proudhon. And I thought that was a really amazing, really great way you handled that. Because Proudhon actually, one, it showed the broadness of mind that Marx and Engels had in terms of reaching out to people like Proudhon, who they had differences with, but they also had a lot that they thought they could bring along. But then there was this point where Proudhon walked up, and the friend that I saw it with, we both saw this, and both being familiar with Marx's work about the philosophy of the poverty of philosophy, when he walks up and he says, "Here's my new book. I think you'll enjoy it. And it's called The Philosophy of Poverty." Really kind of, it was like, oh, it's all gone now. It's all gone down now. Let's talk about that. That was a great move. That was a great scene.
Well, it's a real story. And between the two, you know, they have been playing cat and mouse for a long time. And of course, Marx was at the beginning, he did respect Proudhon. You know, he's like Marx is a very peculiar character. You know, he was very impatient when he felt like you were not progressing like you should do. You know, in particular with great thinker. So he did recognize the importance of Proudhon, and he did respect him quite a lot. But at some point, he felt like Proudhon was being lazy and was not, you know, going further than the space he already had, because Proudhon was already very famous at the time in the movement. So, and he understood, you know, as, you know, the younger son is, all, you know, at one point has to kill his father in order to emerge. You know, somehow this is what happened. And because... that's one of the aspects in the film where I had to find a way to even explain what Marx's position was, you know, as somebody who wanted to install a more scientific socialism, you know. And the two great movements was on the one side, the more utopian socialist, and the, like Proudhon, and the more populist socialist like Weitling. You know, That was the perfect character to show, you know, what exactly Marx and Engels are going for, you know. And of course, I play with the comic situation of it because, again, I'm making a film. I'm not writing a thesis.
Right.
Because the hardest part for us, Pascal Bonitzer and myself, you know, when we were writing is, you know, how do you tell a very powerful and interesting story and keep the attention of the audience, but without inventing things that did not exist, you know, and keeping a very faithful line to really what happened and to the character, you know. We didn't invent one single character who did not exist, you know. We, of course, we set aside certain people, you know, like even Moses Hess, who was a very important historical figure, you know, that was, we had him on the first scene in the newspaper in Cologne, and then he disappeared in the film, although we had scenes that we cut out. But Moses was a very important figure, And by the way, he was one of the father of Zionism, you know, later on in his life. And so we have a lot of character like this that we did not exploit, but we made sure that every character in the film did exist. And we researched and we knew exactly who they were, what they represented, and where they were in the story at the time.
Mm-hmm. One question here now is that you know, and this is something that was really important to me, that one of the things is the point that was made continuously throughout the film is that these are not laws of nature, but laws of man, and they're laws of man-made relations of production. Things don't have to be this way. They're because there's a certain way the society is organized that they are this way, but people need to step up and change that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, that's, you know, starting with Hegel and then Feuerbach, that's the fundamental issue. It's like men make history, and that means if man makes history, that means they can change history. And that's the fundamental importance of that. Mm-hmm. You know, in particular, in a time like this, you know, you would really hear a lot of people who are totally discouraged. You know, they are discouraged against politicians. You know, yes, they are all corrupt, and they are discouraged against even the democratic process of vote. You know, they don't go to vote because, well, it's all rigged and it doesn't make sense, etc. So it's really important to make understand that whatever the situation is, only we can change it. You know, only it's the addition of our strength and our resistance and our engagement that can change anything. You know, and the history of the workers have shown it. You know, nothing that we have today in terms of democracy, in terms of process, was the result of somebody handed it to us. Mm-hmm. It was always the result of fight, of people dying, of people organizing. You know, whether it's the independence of America, whether it's the Civil War and the freedom of the slave, whether it's the civil rights movement, whether it's the feminist movement, the right of vote to women, the right of work, and protection in the workplace, everything is the result of fighting and of people understanding their situation, coming together, fighting together, and imposing the changes.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and this is what we are losing right now.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that ends up in the film with towards the end of the film, the argument, the struggle to actually produce the Communist Manifesto that would unleash the world in a way that had never been seen before, unleash the people of the world in a way that had never been seen before, which I thought was really a really important part of it.
Exactly. And if you remember, by the way, today is the 170th anniversary of the Communist Manifesto. And if you read it today, if you read the first chapter at least, it's exactly the description of what happened in capitalism today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's totally present and current. You know, what he says about the capitalist without, you know, without the brakes that is invading the planet, you know, that there is no limit and that it will go crisis after crisis and destruct a lot of institutions, et cetera, et cetera. So it is exactly what is happening today.
And including in that, the summons to all people to stand up and stop this, which I think is really, really important.
So, of course, yeah, and because there will be no magic.
Right.
And even worse, if you rely only on your anger or on any revolt, that's the best way to do even more damage. Because that's one of the things that you have in the scene with Weitling and Marx, where Weitling is almost saying, well, if everybody is angry enough and we can even use people, criminals from prison and put them in the street to change the system. And Marx said, no, you know, you can't do that. You need to educate the people. They need to know why they are fighting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's exactly. So organization is as important as the knowledge of the situation or as or the anger that you can have. You know, it's like, let's take the Trump voters, you know. Yes, they are pissed. Yes, but what is the reaction? They are voting for a man that is totally on the other side and that will even damage them more. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's totally blind. So you also need to organize and have discussion and really refine your strategy. You know, changing the world means work as well. That's another point that I want to make with the film. You know, you see those young guys, you know, they are in their 20s, but they spend a lot of time also reading, writing, thinking, arguing, discussing with others. You know, it's not just, you know, writing a tweet or writing on Facebook and saying you are angry. That's not enough.
Right.
You know, like the civil rights movement, people risk their life. They put their strengths together. They had to discuss. They train themselves. You know, and that is what is needed today again, unfortunately.
All right, Raoul Peck, thank you very much for a great film, and thanks for the interview, man.
Okay, thank you.
Great Bye-bye. Talking with you. Take care now. Bye. All right, that was Raoul Peck, director and co-writer of The Young Karl Marx. Now we're going to go right into Bob Avakian, chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and the trailer of a talk he gave last October called The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America, a better world is possible. And folks, if you want to get this, and I recommend that everybody go get a copy of this, download it, listen to it, spread it around to all your friends, go to revcom.us and you'll find it there. That's revcom.us. You can also find it at Refuse Fascism.
We are confronted by, we are now being ruled by, a fascist regime, relentlessly assaulting civil rights and liberties and openly promoting bigotry and inequality. This has caused disgust, anger, and agonizing among huge numbers of people. And there have been many important acts of resistance, big and small, to the continuing outrages committed by this regime and its supporters. But the regime remains in power and is determined to ride roughshod over all obstacles to carry out its monstrous agenda. And the need for a massive outpouring of people acting together nonviolently but with sustained determination to create a political situation where this regime cannot remain in power, cries out. The organization Refuse Fascism, refusefascism.org, has put forward a call and a plan and is actively building for that mass mobilization to begin on November 4. So this poses sharply the immediate urgent challenge we face. Calling this regime fascist is not an insult, but speaks to the terrible reality. There is a direct line from the Confederacy to the fascists of today, and a direct connection between their white supremacy, their open disgust and hatred for LGBT people as well as women, their willful rejection of science and the scientific method, their raw America First jingoism and trumpeting of the superiority of Western civilization, and their bellicose wielding of military power, including their expressed willingness and blatant threats to use nuclear weapons to destroy countries with the finger of a demented bully on the nuclear button. A regime that, without exaggeration, threatens not just greatly heightened suffering for the masses of humanity, but the very existence of humanity itself. It used to be a common saying, to the person of the right, order is more important than justice, while for the person of the left, it is the opposite. Now the question is put squarely to liberals, and really to everyone. Which, after all, is more important? Order, even if that is the order of fascism, with everything that means? Or justice, even if that means stepping outside of our comfort zone and putting ourselves on the line to prevent this fascism from consolidating its rule and fully implementing its program. Whether we consider ourselves revolutionaries, convinced of the need for a radical overturning of the system and thorough transformation of society, or We believe that it is possible to bring about changes that will lead to a more just society within this system. Whether our understanding is that America is not and cannot be a force for good in the world, or we hope it still can become that, all of us need to come together and act together with the urgency that corresponds to the terrible present and the gravely imperiled future that this fascist regime represents for humanity, and with the conviction that something far better is necessary and possible. Thousands must be organized to take to the streets in cities all over the country, beginning on November 4. Overcoming fear and feeling the strength of their common cause and action and their common aspiration and determination. Making clear their resolve to not just make a statement, but to continue, and more than that, to spread and multiply their numbers and impact until millions have been mobilized and refuse to stop until the demand has been met. This nightmare must end. The Trump-Pence regime must go.
All right, that was Bob Avakian, and the talk was a trailer from a talk he gave last October. The Trump-Pence regime must go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible. The video of the entire one-hour talk is available at revcom.us. We're going to take a quick break and be right back, so stay tuned.
Cats like me and you have got lost, but they adhere to laws outside the laws as laid down by those we don't subscribe to. The world is getting stranger.
All right, welcome back. That was Revolution by the Pretenders, and we couldn't ask for a more fitting song given the world we're faced with today. George Prochnick is an author and writer for The New Yorker, and shortly after the Trump inauguration, he had a piece in The New Yorker called When It's Too Late to Stop Fascism, According to Stefan Zweig. Now, in the 1930s, Austrian writer Stefan Zweig was the most translated author in the world. He fled Austria when the Nazis took over in 1934, and then he was in exile in 1941. He spent his final months of his life furiously writing a memoir, what he called a warning to future societies. He had learned firsthand what it meant to not take on fascism when it first arose. Quite a horror. And so without any further ado, let's jump into the interview that I did with George Prochnick just the other day. I interviewed George Prochnick. He's a writer, and he has an article in the February 6th edition of the New Yorker magazine. And his article was When It's Too Late to Stop Fascism, and he, according to Stefan Zweig. And he, you know, he wrote this, and he said, you know, he looked at in the 1930s, Stefan Zweig, as I said earlier, was the most translated author in the world. He fled Austria when the Nazis took over in 1934. He was in exile, and in 1941 he went into exile in the States, in the U.S. He spent the final months of his life furiously writing a memoir, and the memoir was a warning to the people of the future. All right. And he had learned firsthand what it meant not to take on fascism when it first arises, what the consequences are. So without any further ado, we're going to listen to this interview I did with George Prochnick just a couple days ago. Check this out. I recently read a piece in The New Yorker. It was a very powerful piece, and it was called According to Stefan Zweig, and it was by George Prochnick. When I read it,
I thought, I've got to talk to George. I've got to have him on the show to talk about this because it is such a compelling piece and it's such a necessary and important piece today, given what's going on in the world. So I'm really happy to welcome George to the show. George, I'm glad you're here.
Well, thanks so much for having me on and for what you said about the piece.
Well, let's jump into this. You recently wrote a piece in The New Yorker about the Austrian writer Stefan Zweig and his memoir, The World of Yesterday, that he wrote in the summer of 1941. Tell people who Zweig was and why his memoir was so significant that you felt you had to write about this.
Well, Zweig was an affluent Austrian Jew. He grew up in Vienna at the height of its cosmopolitan glamour. He himself, from a very early age, decided that his vocation was writing and was successful immediately. He began writing poetry, then he was writing essays for newspapers, and everything that he did found an audience. He began then writing extremely popular short stories, political essays, eventually histories, a novel, biographies, a libretto, a play. Everything that Zweig did added to his worldly acclamation, and he saw himself, because he became so popular, not just within Austria, but in fact worldwide. And at the pinnacle of his career in the mid-1920s, he was the most widely translated author in the world and quite possibly the most successful. He saw himself as representing all the values of humanism that he hoped the historical trends were going to affirm more and more as his life went on. The first, of course, terrible blow to this dream was the First World War, which shattered the original Habsburg Empire balance between different ethnic groups, which was a vexed balance, but one which, at least for a period of time, kept the worst aspects of prejudice and ethnic denigration in check. After that war, Zweig decided that more important to himself than being a celebrity author would be the project of doing what he could to promote tolerance, international humanism, etc. And even though he continued to write at an extraordinarily prolific rate, he spent even more time, arguably, organizing different conferences, giving talks, trying to bring together the leading humanists from everywhere, from the East as well as from the West, to talk about what could be done to ensure that the catastrophe of the First World War was not repeated. So throughout this time, leading up to the rise of fascism in the late 20s and early 30s, before Hitler actually came to power, Zweig felt that his own situation, despite his grave concern for other more vulnerable populations, that his own situation was relatively immune. And, of course, after the Nazis came to power and eventually Austria as well, later in the 1930s, became threatened and collapsed and fell under Nazi rule, Zweig found himself suddenly among the refugee population that he had watched with compassion and with a terrible sense of premonition, dating way back to after 1933 when Hitler became chancellor. So after he himself left Austria, he went to England and then he went to the United States and eventually he ended up in Brazil. But in the United States, he did the bulk of work on his memoir in the summer of 1941, living in, of all places, a small town up the Hudson from New York City called Osnig. He lived in a house, a very modest house, not like the grand apartments and grand hotels in which he had spent most of his life, very close to Sing Sing prison. And he worked furiously on this memoir because he wasn't trying so much to preserve a record of his private existence. It says virtually nothing about his own domestic life. What he was trying to do was to look at what had happened to his generation and understand how even someone as privileged as himself, let alone the millions, without all the buffers that he had thought would barricade him against the worst effects of fascism, how those had all fallen away. So the document, what he ended up producing in an incredibly rapid rate, he was sometimes writing several hundred pages in a shorter period of a few weeks. What he ended up producing is this extraordinary, I guess we would say, almost a record in real time of how a civilization which had seemed so secure and so invested in its progressive democratic values could have collapsed so utterly and in a relatively short period of time. He really tries to look at this, and I am convinced, having spent a great deal of time with this book, that there are lessons which are sadly very pertinent for us today.
That was one of the really important points that you made in this article. this whole idea of even the title of the book, The World of Yesterday, and he's speaking to an audience that clearly it's not an audience that was necessarily living in the time that he was writing about and was actually looking to the future. And if he actually could conceive of a future given what was going on in the world at the time and what the future might be. But that whole idea of speaking to people about what actually, this is a warning. This is a warning to the future. And I thought the point that he made is that it's a law of history that contemporaries are denied a recognition of the early beginnings of the great movements which determine their times. If you look throughout history, that has so much importance in seeing how things develop and how things get to the point that they get to.
That's absolutely correct. Everything that you just said. First of all, in terms of the book as a message to the future, I think he literally conceived of it as a kind of message in a bottle to the future. He knew that his own generation was going to be immersed in, as he said, the abyss and unspeakable hells for as long ahead in time as he himself, at the age of 60 when he was composing this, could see, or 59 and about to turn 60. But at the same time, he didn't think that the Nazis would ultimately destroy the planet. What he felt was that if there was anything that he could give to allow the next generation to rebuild civilization on sounder grounds, that there could be no higher mission he could take on. To your point, where you mentioned how it's denied to contemporaries to see what will become the great or the most important movements of their time, this is something that Zweig very, very poignantly presents. When Hitler first began to make a name for himself, which was in the early 1920s, nobody took him seriously because he seemed a buffoon, uneducated, so crude and ultimately unlikable that the elite, the intellectuals, couldn't imagine that this person would ever become a threat to the entire German, Austrian, and ultimately global culture. You know, there's another scene that I think of in this context. This son of the writer Thomas Mann, Klaus Mann, who was also an author, described having seen Hitler early on at a Munich tea house. And he's watching Hitler stuff his face with these cream puffs, and he's, as he puts it, such a petty bourgeois pig, and so nasty, and so, in a visceral way, not a leader, not a figure who seems capable of inspiring the urge for greater German glory, or let alone any kind of preserving any ideals of civilization. He says, this man can never be a threat to us. And he says, it's impossible. And I think in our own situation here, it's obviously the case that Trump had been around for many years in the public eye. No one who was in a position to stop him understood for a very long time that he might be capable of channeling some sort of mood of a large swath of the country that could ultimately sweep him into power.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and today we're talking to George Prochnick, who's the author of a piece in The New Yorker called According to Stefan Zweig, a really important and chilling warning about the past and the future. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and today we're talking to George Prochnick, who's the author of a piece in The New Yorker called According to Stefan Zweig, a really important and chilling warning about the past and the future. You know, one of the things that comes up, too, in your piece, and I thought it really made me pause, because at the same time as what you're talking about in terms of Zweig and what he began to understand, when he actually was out there, at one point, he even ended up applauding the Nazis for their ability to bring, I think you say, a renewed sense of passion and import to German elections. And I kept thinking about the whole idea that somebody can get in there and mix it up, and really the idea is to get people, set people's heads on fire, and then you can actually get in there and wrestle with some things. But this was a fairly stunning thing to see somebody who did care the way he cared about what was going on, and then at the same time to be sort of blindsided by this whole point of the Nazis had an ability to bring a renewed sense of passion and import to the German elections.
I think that's a very important point. And again, there are certainly people who looked on, who continue to look on. I've seen this phrase in a number of relatively mainstream conservative essays and sites now, but the idea that, well, what this president is doing is acting like a bull in the china shop. You know, we had a huge problem. Something had to happen. He's there. He's going to shake things up. And there's this almost sly little winking, joking sense that they're going to know how to rein this force in at the right time. And historically speaking, the idea that you can control a charismatic maverick at the moment you decide it's gone too far has just been disproven time and again. And I think we have to be very clear that the passions that a leader can excite, even though those passions may have different motivations and be from all sorts of different demographics with different goals in mind. They don't in any way validate the larger platform on which a charismatic leader runs. The passions may be real and sincere and have positive elements. That doesn't make anything that the leader himself represents something that we as a country can abide by.
And that's extremely important. I mean, again, you look at what's going on today and think about this. I mean, all the things that we got in the build-up to the election where it was like, look, the people from the Rust Belt are really coming forward. And it was this whole people who haven't voted, people who've been so alienated from the system. Mm-hmm. And finally, they found their hero. And when I'm reading your piece, I'm thinking, damn, it's like way too much. There's way too much similarity here.
Right. There were so many reasons to be skeptical that he would be a hero of those demographics who felt forgotten, disenfranchised, etc. I mean, beginning, of course, with his vast wealth and his notorious lack of generosity as a human being in every sense. But he said what people wanted to hear. And, I think another point that Zweig makes, though, that's relevant, because it's obvious that that vote of the Trump's words of, the forgotten man, that mattered. But another thing that Zweig points out about Hitler's ascendancy, the moment when Zweig himself, began to take Hitler seriously, was when he realized how much money was being spent on the different squads of young men that he saw training in these towns along the Austrian-German border. They would be driving new trucks, wearing these spanking new uniforms, and all very, very well healed in their appearance. And he realized that there were financial interests using the nascent Nazi Party as a front. And there was unquestionably also a great deal of moneyed interest behind Trump, and that shouldn't be lost sight of. And moneyed interests who have since the election, however they voted, come to decide, well, maybe this can work in our favor after all. I mean, a friend was telling me recently of a friend of his who is involved with a hedge fund that made hundreds of millions of dollars in the initial weeks after Trump's election. Obviously, there's this enormous rally on Wall Street. So there has also been an acceptance of the more heinous, from the point of view of human rights, actions taken by the administration. I think, unfortunately, because the greed of people with money is so far still being gratified. So it isn't only that this one population found its hero. It's that another population found someone who would allow them to become that much richer and, in fact, increase the very socioeconomic inequalities that in some way made this president possible.
Now, let's move into this, because you say in your piece that Zweig recognized the crucial role of propaganda in eroding the conscience of the world at the time, and this was a massive boon to what Hitler was trying to do. Let's talk about that, because there seems to be a lot you can draw between that situation with Hitler and Trump.
Well, absolutely. One point that Zweig makes is that at the outset of the First World War, it was still possible for a poet, for an intellectual, for an eloquent voice to intervene in the clamor towards war and make a statement that even if it didn't halt the progress towards war, would at least cause enough of a controversy, enough of a dissension within that rush into bloodshed, that there was some hope that you could affect the course of history by sufficiently articulating the dangers of what lay ahead. But over the course of that war, what modern propaganda, what we think of as modern propaganda, really took hold and saturated all forms of media, not just print media, but radio as well. And Zweig documents to an extent how the very capacity to exaggerate the fear of strangers, the dangers posed by foreigners, became a not just self-perpetuating, but an expanding, snowballing phenomenon, so that by the end of the war, Zweig actually labeled what the press was doing as the doping of excitement, that there was just a need to produce a certain kind of effect on readers or listeners so that you would continue to have what we would today call an audience share. By the time the Second World War was becoming more and more imminent, Zweig says that the organization of lies, which is how he describes propaganda, had become so effective that it was no longer possible for anyone to say anything that could have the slightest effect on the rush into the madness that terrible war became. And there were so many eloquent statements in the period leading up to our own election period. I think of Michelle Obama's rightly celebrated speech at the DNC convention and any number of other instances that if it was possible for words to matter to the whole population, they would have mattered at those moments. And unfortunately, it's obvious that our segmented news, our ability to curate our own news feeds through social media, our lack of any common standard of truth has led to a situation in which propaganda is now seen as by one side or the other, and I would argue infinitely more perniciously on the side of the right, it is now viewed as just the situation with news. You're looking for an affirmation of your opinion, not for some sort of a factual report. And in that situation, I don't know how you find common ground again.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and today we're talking to George Prochnick, who's the author of a piece in The New Yorker called According to Stefan Zweig, a really important and chilling warning about the past and the future. Well, one of the things, too, though, that is very, very important in relation to all this is the fact that propaganda has that other role, which is, as you point out, is both actually whips up Hitler's base. That's what it did in Germany. It whipped up his base. And it covered for some of the most brutal things that he was doing as he was consolidating his hold on power. And that people actually didn't see the truth. They were blurred into wishful thinking. Truth was blurred into wishful thinking, even as all these terrible things were going on.
Absolutely. The combination, as you just said, of how propaganda can hide from people what's actually going on and stir sentiments to encourage the worst excesses. We've seen that. And we've also seen the last point that you made about how in a situation where everything feels so chaotic and dangerous, any gesture towards normalcy becomes something that people just grasped for desperately. And there was that long period in the run-up, both after the election and the period leading up to the election, when I felt as if Trump had only to not do anything awful for 24 hours, 36 hours, and you have extraordinary statements on the part of CNN where it began to sound as though this was a clear indication that he had converted and become just like any other politician. It took so little for people to want to project so much onto any sign that things were not going to be as disastrous as many people feared.
I have two more questions for you, and one is a question that you pose in the article, which is how far along the scale of moral degeneration Zweig would judge America to be today under Trump?
Well, I think that one heartening phenomenon here has obviously been the strength of the resistance to all sorts of different measures that have been promulgated by the White House. That has been the marches, the boycotts have shown that the population is hardly subdued. And there are lots of positive signs of people's understanding that this has to sustain itself and build momentum. One thing that is clear about Trump's character is that he is capable of being thrown off balance. And I say only slightly tongue-in-cheek that I wish that some of the energy of the Occupy movement might turn into a pre-Occupy Trump movement. And I think this could take all sorts of different forms. More boycotts, strikes, obviously marches. Every possible effort to disrupt his own effort to give a veneer of everydayness to what is in fact a radical politics. So that's the good sign. I think in terms of where we are with news, where we are in terms of doubts about the checks and balance in our government, what's the sweep that the GOP had on every level, not just in terms of Congress, but in terms of the governorships, etc. Things are a lot rockier, particularly because the GOP has shown itself to be so absolutely spineless. The point that Zweig makes is that you can have that particularly dangerous equation of eroded shared values and eroded institutions, and things might still not tip all the way over until something catastrophic happens. In the case of Germany, less than 30 days after Hitler became chancellor, that was the Reichstag fire, the burning of the parliament building, which the Nazis blamed on the communists, and which there remains some doubt about today as to whether that might not in fact have been set by the Nazis themselves. But regardless, once that happened, Hitler immediately imposed a raft of emergency measures that shut down justice entirely. And what I worry about here is the big event, whatever form it takes, or the fabricated big event, but something that becomes an excuse. And we've already seen Trump manufacture terrorist incidents, manufacture the threat posed by different demographics in ways that could really spin things very quickly into a different place than we find ourselves in today.
Mm-hmm. Now, you answered a good part of my next question, but I'm going to read what I was going to, the last sentence in your article, and you can comment on it. You say the excruciating power of Zweig's memoir lies in the pain of looking back and seeing that there was a small window in which it was possible to act, and then discovering how suddenly and irrevocably that window can be slammed shut. That's sort of what you were just talking about now, but it's also something that really needs to be emphasized because, frankly, I'm really happy to see all of the resistance that's out in the streets, and we need, you know, there is a need for a whole hell of a lot more. There needs to be millions of people in the streets, millions and millions, to actually speak to the towering, you know, horrible situation that exists today. But I thought your last sentence really puts out a very sharp warning to people, a small window in which it's possible to act, and then discovering how suddenly it can be slammed shut.
Thanks, and I agree with you that what's happened so far, there needs to be more of it, and unfortunately, there's not going to be an opportunity to tire of it. This is not something that is going to go away quickly. In a best case scenario, I think there's a fight here that's going to have to be waged for a long time, and it's been heartening to see that enough Americans have a spirit of defiance of injustice, that they're willing to break up the routines of their own lives and speak out against what's going on, but we need more of it, and I really hope that the different groups, not only vulnerable, but different groups with different kinds of privilege can find ways of resisting together, because it's only in a very powerful and relentless co-resistance that we're going to keep that window open long enough to actually get these people out of power.
All right. Thank you very much, George. I want to really express my appreciation for the article and for coming on to the show, too. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with George Prochnick. Now, George is the author of The Impossible Exile, Stefan Zweig at the End of the World. And he had an article in The New Yorker titled, When It's Too Late to Stop Fascism, According to Stefan Zweig.
All right, that brings us to the end of yet another show. I'd like to remind listeners that the entire talk by Bob Avakian, the Trump-Pence regime must go, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America, a better world is possible, is available at revcom.us. You can also find the link on my Facebook page. And go to Fandango, or your favorite movie site, and find out when you can see The Young Karl Marx. I want to thank all the people who worked on this show this week. My assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and each and every one of you for tuning in.
If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with what has become one of my favorite songs, The Voice of Revolution, from Savage Rose. Talk to you again next week.